Okay, welcome everybody to this evening's public lecture with Barbara Stocking, Director of Oxfam, who's going to speak to us about Making Poverty History, Is It Possible? And Barbara has a long background in working in health. She was in the top management team of the National Health Service in the UK and worked there for about 8 years and contributing to the modernisation of the NHS. In May 2001, she made the leap into Oxfam, and I've just learned that it was always her vision and dream to work in international development, and I think now she's realising her dream. She's done a lot in the last 4 years, responding to humanitarian crises in Afghanistan, Iraq and Sudan, and also for the tsunami, and has done considerable work in strengthening Oxfam's campaigning, particularly around issues like making trade fair, education now, and has pushed for Oxfam's scale-up of development work, for example, on livelihoods and HIV/AIDS. And I'm very pleased to welcome her this evening to speak about the Making Poverty History campaign, about which we've heard an awful lot this year. And I'm also very pleased to find out this is actually the first occasion, public occasion, when she is going to give a reflective talk on the campaign. So I think we feel very honoured that LSE is going to be the host of this reflection. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's very nice to see so many people here. Very nice, but rather daunting, actually, especially when I hear there's another room somewhere with people in as well. So I hope I'll live up to the expectations. Let me just tell you what I'm going to cover, then, because I always know people like to know sort of the beginning, middle, and end. I'm going to talk a bit about this question, just to start with, and give a bit of my views on it. Then I'm going to talk a bit about the Make Poverty History campaign and what it was standing for and asking for, and then a bit on where we've got to as we come towards the end of the year. And then I want to get into a bit more about the way the campaign worked and some of the questions and dilemmas a campaign like this brings with it, and finish off with a quick bit on where it goes from here. So that's, if you want to sort of know when to have a nap, you know, how it works its way through. So this question, Make Poverty History, is it really possible? Well, I certainly believe it personally, and certainly Oxfam does, and the people within the whole Make Poverty History coalition do. And why is that the case? Well, first of all, there is a bit of history in all this, and where better to speak of this particular bit of history than LSE? Because, first of all, if you think back to Victorian times and the extreme poverty that there was then, and think that actually in the UK we were able to overcome that, it does actually give you some hope that you could do this globally. Because at the time, in the Victorian era, actually, for most people, their horizons were really quite limited. And it was, you know, the middle classes who could see the rather bigger pictures around the country. Now, we're in a different world where you can know what's going on worldwide. So in a sense, our world has got bigger and we can see more. But it's not too unlike, you know, those Victorians who saw that actually something had to be done to end extreme poverty in the UK. And we are talking about extreme poverty. I mean, clearly, there will always, I believe, be differentiation in wealth amongst people. But if you take the extreme poverty, you know, people living under $1 a day or $2 a day, that's what we're talking about. That's what can actually be overcome in the world. Now, that's a sort of bit of history, why this sort of gives us some hope that it can be done. There's also the practicalities of it. The sorts of amounts of money that we're talking about that you might need to deal with poverty are actually really quite small compared to other amounts of money in the world. I mean, we've been talking this year about an extra $50 billion a year in aid money. Now, that is absolute peanuts compared to some other figures. Let me give you two. Right now, in a year, $1 trillion is spent on arms. That is, for those who don't deal in trillions, that's 1,000 billion. That's how much is spent on arms each year. Equally, what I heard from Transparency International the other day was that an equivalent, $1 trillion a year, is also spent on facilitation payments, i.e. bribery, in the world. Now, if you can spend $1 trillion on arms, and you can spend $1 trillion on bribes, it surely is not impossible to spend another $50 billion a year on aid. It's just that, you know, these comparisons make you realise just how small this is that for things to happen. But of course, I don't want to pretend that just getting money is enough. Clearly, some of the biggest things that I'll come on to are about trade as well, and they're a bit less easy to change. They're less easy to change because they start biting into the political systems, the interests of people in particular countries. So sometimes people will have to give something to get that better outcome. But again, I think the argument can be very easily made that that's really worthwhile. It's worthwhile for all of us and our long-term peace and security. It's also worthwhile, even if you only think it in really rather consumerist terms, that actually we've pretty well saturated the consumerist populations of the North. And if you really do want an economic world that's vibrant and bubbling and people do want more things, then you're going to have to develop the rest of the world to make that possible. That may be a rather cynical view of it, but it certainly says, you know, that's reasons why it can be done. And I think the other thing about why poverty can be ended is really that there is pretty substantial agreement on what it would take. Obviously, the Make Poverty History campaign has been specifically about aid, trade and debt. And you might add a few more items to that, which others are the good governance in the South and so on. But you don't have to add much more for it to become a pretty agreed package of things that are needed. The things that were in the UK Africa Commission report are not very different at all for what was in the UN report on the Millennium Project, the totality of the Millennium Development Goals and what was needed to achieve them. They're not very different things. The diagnosis is pretty clear. So the diagnosis is clear. The money is not huge. The question is, has anybody got the political will to do it, really? So I absolutely believe that you can make poverty history, but how far have we got with it this year? Well, I want to just come on and show you the things. Let's start with Make Poverty History and what it was. Make Poverty History is a coalition of a lot of organisations in the UK, including NGOs, including church groups, including the unions, something over 400 different organisations actually taking part to make this year a very special year. You will remember that the reason why this year, it's because basically G8 was being held in the UK with a pretty supportive government towards development. The UN summit was being held in September to look at the progress on the Millennium Development Goals. And coming up, December the 17th, we've got the World Trade Organization meeting. So you've got some pretty big targets to say if we could shift things this year, you really have got a chance to make poverty history. That's why people came together in the UK. And perhaps the most powerful country in terms of campaigning was the UK this year. But it has been one of a whole load of countries where different groups have set up as part of the total global call to action against poverty. And out of this have come some pretty clear objectives and some pretty clear demands of politicians. And I want to put those up. Oh, I've gone back too far. Right, I'll do that. Hope the best there. Yeah. Now, there were really three major calls in the UK Make Poverty History. And the first one was about trade. Trade justice, not free trade. And the three particular calls within that, the first one was very much about countries themselves choosing to take their own paths out of poverty and using trade as part of that. Not having things pushed on them, because many of you will know, often under things like World Bank, IMF loans, all sorts of conditions are put on about how people should liberalise their trade. Equally, in the WTO negotiations, very heavy pressure put on people to liberalise, forgetting that actually many of our own countries, including the UK, but including obviously the recent developers, have had periods of protection for their own industries or for their own food security during those times. So, finding your own way, not being forced into that. Ending export subsidies that end up with much dumping of products in developing countries so that people there cannot work their way out of poverty. And making sure that big business does not profit out of people at the expense of the environment, out of people and the environment. So those were the three calls, really, on trade that were part of Make Poverty History. Then the second call came out very much of the Jubilee debt campaign, because you remember this is all the coalitions coming together, that the unpayable debts of the poorest countries should be cancelled in full. And in particular, what that meant this year was actually dealing with multilateral debt, the debt that is owed to the big international financing institutions, IMF and World Bank and some of the other big banks. So that was the second call to action. And the third one was more aid, increasing by that $50 billion a year, but also setting a timetable of 0.7% on aid, which is a bit over the $50 billion, but is something that has been promised now. I think it's something like 35 years that governments made the international commitment to 0.7% of GDP on aid, really a remarkably long time. Now, and just to add on, that in the global call to action, they took on these basically exactly the same sort of lines, but added into that the good governance one, the recognition that you could have all these, and these are basically demands, particularly to the rich countries, but you could have all these, but unless you've got good governance in the countries where this money is arriving, then you're still not going to get there. You need that the quality of government actually in the countries themselves. Now, again, all these things need to be put together to make a whole package work. And I think for any individual country, the issues, again, about finding their own path to development. In the course of this year, I've ended up in some remarkably silly debates about whether it's better to put your money into health services or into education or whatever. And actually people trying to do analysis about how it'd be more useful to spend a particular dollar on this or that. Now, you may need to do some analysis of what each one buys, but clearly for each country, you have to understand where it is and actually what its strategy for getting out of poverty is, and therefore which bits of support it needs, particularly in aid, and where that aid should be spent. And those decisions need to be made by those countries themselves. The only way I can look at it is, as I was having this argument at one point, I shouldn't give them the credence of a group, but there was an American, a Danish group of economists actually trying to prove which was the best way to do this. And the only answer I could give was that if you send a child to school and they're actually ill, they're not going to learn very much. If you send a child to school with an empty stomach, they're not going to learn very much. You just can't do this. You can't choose these things. People actually have to build up the package of what is really necessary in their country. You know, where's the gaps? What needs it to be added on? What's the mix of things that you really need to do in your own country? Now, let me first of all have a look very practically then about what's been delivered this year. The highlight was certainly in the UK, the G8 meetings. But there have been the meetings before. There was G7, that's the finance ministers, G8, the heads of state, the UN, heads of all the world's governments, and endless meetings beyond. And how far did we get with all this? Well, a bit. And let me just run through those. On the debt relief, I think we've made a considerable breakthrough in that the principle is now accepted that actually the multilateral debt should be cancelled. The problem is it's very hard work to get this delivered in practice. And let me explain what I mean. We all cheered when G7, the finance ministers, said, yes, we'll pay up for 18 countries to have the poorest countries to have their multilateral debt relief delivered. We said, that's great. And then we waited, and then we had to fight for it again in the G8 meetings. That's odd, isn't it? Government's promise, and then you have to fight again for that to be confirmed by the governments of the rich countries. So then we thought we got it in the bag. You know, 18 countries got debt relief. Well, no, it wasn't quite like that. You got to the UN summit, and that had to be reconfirmed yet again. Was that it? No. It then had to go to the IMF and World Bank annual meetings, because this is writing off the debt to the IMF and the World Bank. It finally got through there with a lot of trouble. Is that it? No, it then had to go through the boards of the IMF and the World Bank. And I checked today, and as we speak, it is still not absolutely a done deal that the 18 countries have got debt relief. Now, frankly, I think that's disgusting. If I in Oxfam was to promise something, my equivalent of, a country's debt relief, and I didn't deliver that, we would be out of a job straight away. The idea that governments can keep promising and you have to keep re-lobbying, re-campaigning to actually get them to deliver is just absolutely disgraceful. But there we are. But we've got the principle of debt relief established, multilateral debt relief. And people who've been around this longer than I have keep saying, you've got to remember that actually, 10 years ago, that would have been thought of as completely impossible. So we've got the principle, and we've probably just about have cracked the money, and I think we will by the end of the year, but I wouldn't like to, you have to be a bit careful about this. Not they find so many ways not to quite make it that you just worry before you commit. Then on the aid money, again, that's a fascinating story. In a way, yes, we've sort of got it. Basically, what we've got, assuming they all pay up, of course, is that by 2010, there will be another $48 billion a year in aid, so nearly the $50 billion by 2010. And that's compared to the figures of 2004. You have to keep comparing the figures. We've got that with there were some early promises of money already sort of in there, but the big push and the big breakthrough was actually the EU governments really committing themselves to actually giving more aid by 2010. And you have to say, that's fantastic, really. We've nearly got that amount more aid money. But again, let me just give you the caveat on that, which is not just getting to make sure the money is there, but actually it is 2010. You sort of think, well, how many children will have died in that time? How many more children won't have had education in that time? So it's good, but it's not good enough. So that's two sort of, not bads, really. And then the one where we're still extremely concerned is, of course, trade. And again, trade is the one that thoroughly irritates me, because actually the G8 committed themselves to getting rid of export subsidies, not in 2005, but in 2004. And interestingly, they recommitted themselves in 2005, but they didn't set out a timetable for dealing with these export subsidies. They just said, yes, they were committed to do it. But of course, what it is, it's part of a negotiating package that's going forward towards the World Trade Organization. So it's not whatever happens, you're going to get export subsidies. It's that export subsidies are being put on the table as part of negotiations when developing countries may be expected to give something else in return, like opening their borders, reducing tariffs, whatever it is that's wanted. So trade is a real ongoing problem. And for those of you who are following the debates, you'll know that actually the upcoming meeting in Hong Kong, the World Trade Organization meeting in Hong Kong, is going to be extremely difficult because it's meant to be a development round in which agriculture is at the centre and in which the people of developing countries get something from this round. And yet all the time things are brought in as part of this negotiating package about things like services or the non-agricultural products and so on that are all actually ways to negotiate a good deal for particularly the EU, Japan and the US in a negotiation with developing countries. It's not actually a developing country round. And I mean, all of our people, not just in Oxfam, but in the trade justice movement in the UK, but Make Poverty History more widely, are all really worried that actually the developing countries may get a very bad deal. And we're all sort of sitting there saying, well, actually, it may be better not to have a deal than to have a really bad deal, because once you're built into it, that's what you're stuck with. So, and I said earlier, trade is the one where it's really hard because people have to give something up. The subsidies going to cotton farmers in America or to sugar farmers in the UK and Europe, that does mean a change in those industries. They're not just things where you can just give some money. They are things that are going to hurt some people, usually the wealthiest, actually. But nevertheless, that trade is going to hurt some people, and some very powerful people at that. So I just want to say the other bit, though, that I think that has been achieved this year, and that is that fundamental question that we started with about, do people believe that you can make poverty history? And I think the thing that's happened is far, far more people, especially in the UK, really do think that there is something wrong with the world with this level of extreme poverty, and most importantly, that something can be done about it. And I think that has been a real change in attitude, as I say, particularly in the UK, but amongst some other people in parts of the world. But I want to go on now a bit and explain a bit more about the parts of this campaign and some of the difficult issues that it raised about how to campaign. And first of all, just one picture, just to, again, to coming back to this point, that Make Poverty History is, if you like, the UK branch of the Global Call to Action Against Poverty, and that's actually people in India campaigning in the White Band Week, basically asking governments to, holding governments to account for making poverty history. So what were the ways that we went about thinking about this whole campaign? Well, there are clearly different routes you can campaign. You can do the insider route. You can try and lobby heavily, and of course you have to do that, whether that's with the UK government, the other G8 governments, the Indian government on trade, for example, the international finance institutions. You've got the whole sort of lobbying mechanism. But really, I think what the whole campaign has been about this year is been saying, we'll never get these changes unless a mass of people really believe this is possible. Because we're living now in a globalized world where, at least in many countries, people are actually able to influence their politicians. They are actually able to make demands of their politicians about what they want. And therefore, actually having a mass of people who are out there saying, we want these changes, is very important if people are going to have the political will to go through, and especially on some of the difficult decisions. Now this is quite a contentious issue in its own right, and I'm quite happy to debate this afterwards. Because if you remember my beginning bit about the Victorians, of course the Victorians didn't go about their change in this way at all. It was pretty well the middle classes who actually saw the obscene poverty of child chimney sweeps and all the rest of it. It wasn't really the masses that were calling for an end to poverty. What we saw, though, more in the 20th century was, though, that actually mass campaigns really can bring about change. And perhaps the most central and obvious one of that is the civil rights movement in the US. So, in a sense, we have an unproven sort of assumption here that if only enough people would raise their voices, whether it's in the UK to the British government or in the South, both challenging their own governments and challenging Northern governments to deliver, that this could really happen. And I do think this is a real assumption that is unproven. It certainly, I think, has helped in the UK. There's no doubt that the British government knew what a mass there was behind them and wanted that mass there not only to convince the British public about doing something, but equally to convince other governments like the German and the French governments that actually there was enough political support, that it was people that were driving them to do this and that they did want that. I'm sure that's true in the UK. We haven't really proved it, though, in much of the rest of the world. We haven't proved that we've got the masses really engaged, and proved yet that if you had, they would really change their governments and their actions. But we've gone about this, about saying, let us really work with this idea that actually, if humanity, if you like, cares enough about this and wants to do this, the political will be there. That's the hypothesis we've been working on. Then the question is, well, how do you get people on board then? And of course, then you get into some other contentious issues. You get into the issues about things like celebrities. Do you or don't you use celebrities? Again, we can debate that one in a while. How do you get your messages across in a way that's simple enough, but not so simple as they're actually, bordering on lying, really? How can you make these crisp messages? How do you make them real? Something that is actually you can take, if you take the headline, you can go back under that and get the detail that really shows what you're talking about there. How do you get that across to people who are very busy with their own lives and don't want to know too much about all this? How do you actually get people to feel engaged? How do you get them to feel that they personally can do something? Because we do know that the one thing we are clear about is that, people will feel more engaged if they can do something and take part. And then, of course, you get into those issues about, well, what do you want them to do? You certainly want them to text Tony Blair if they're in the UK or their governments in other countries. Of course, one of the big things of this year was the white armband. And can you get people to wear white armbands to show that they're part of this, to show that they're prepared, if you like, to stand up and be counted? So it's all those things about thinking about how you go about campaigning, how you actually enable people to do something so that they're part of it. What I'm just going to show now is a one-minute video that was done quite early on in the year. It was an ad, actually, for Make Poverty History. showing the use of both some political leaders and celebrities, and coming out with this, you know, what you can do, the action point. But also, you'll see it wasn't early in the year, because one of the things you can do is you can go to Edinburgh for July the 2nd. Well, clearly that's over now, but we still got WTO on December the 17th, so don't forget. But have a look at the video just for a minute and see this is part of, you know, going about campaigning.
Free humanity from poverty, disease.
Millions among the living struggle to survive in conditions of poverty.
There can be change. There can be hope for Africa.
Éradiquer la faim, la pauvreté, la maladie.
First generation that can end extreme poverty. By that I mean the kind of stupid poverty that allows a child to die of hunger in a world of plenty.
2005 is the year to make history, to make poverty history.
But how it happens, it's up to us all.
To make it the most powerful movement the world has ever known, we need all citizens around the world to stand up and be counted.
We're calling for trade justice, an end to debt, and more and better aid.
2005 has to be the decisive year in the battle against poverty.
I'm going to be joining millions of others around the world by wearing my white band in 2005.
Make poverty history.
So that's the sort of, you know, one of the ads that we use. Some of you may have also seen the click ads where actually celebrities click their finger, and actually every time they do, every 3 seconds, that signifies, you know, another child in the world has died. So there are all sorts of ways that people were trying to find to bring home to people what this poverty issue is all about, and then get people to take action to do something about it. And as I said, I do think that's probably been one of the biggest successes of the year, that people are really felt that something should be done, and that they personally, by doing some small action, could actually make a difference. And I think it's quite phenomenal that it's the research shows that actually 7 million people have worn white armbands in the UK this year, of which one third of all 16 to 24 year olds have worn, bought or worn, to be precise, bought or worn white armbands. Now, I don't actually think that they've all bought or worn white armbands because they all believe that about, you know, that they have to get rid of poverty. I'm sure some people have worn them as a fashion accessory, but never mind. That's only a proportion. A lot of them have worn it because they feel that they want to be part of this cause and they want to stand up and be counted in it. So those are some of the, you know, the campaigning dilemmas. And maybe just to point out one or two other things about the campaign that some of you will know about what's happened in the course of this year. Clearly, holding a coalition together, like Make Poverty History, with so many different people has been incredibly difficult. To get 420 organisations to stand together, I mean, clearly just to get those three big asks agreed at the beginning of the year was a phenomenal thing to have done, really, and to get people to stick together. Given that people have different political views, I think it's been an incredible achievement to have got through this year and still be together and all still be talking to each other. Mm-hmm. In the middle of G8 at Make Poverty History, I was feeling a bit flattened about, you know, are we all getting the same message and everything? And somebody said to me, just remember the Jubilee Debt campaign. You remember when they came out of that, they weren't even speaking to each other anymore. So, you know, it is hard because people care about these things, care about the precision of the, you know, what's being called for. So actually to come out and actually say we're all still standing together, I think is really quite something. As well as celebrities, of course, another big issue has been this question about co-option by government. And there, I feel quite robust on this. I don't think we're there either to be pro or anti a government. We're there to make poverty history. And actually, the tactics that you use are the ones that are actually the ones that are most likely to deliver a real change. And in terms of the UK, as I was saying before, the UK government, on this particular matter at least, has been very, very strong and sound. And the issue has been, can you persuade the other governments, particularly the other G8 governments, to play their part in all this? Now, if you have to actually really show that you're behind the British government and keep pushing it and try to set its ambition higher, if that helps to convince those other governments, then I'm all for that. But there is a question about co-option and making sure that you're not seen to be just with the government, whatever it says. And especially when the government takes on all your words as well. That's the we had some meetings about, could you please stop acting like Make Poverty History is yours? Because it's not. You know, you're the responsible people that we are lobbying to, you know, so don't just be, you be careful as well in all this. So those are some of the issues, and we can talk, I mean, you'll probably have views about those, and it would be very interesting to hear them. So that's been, you know, something about the campaigning this year. I just want to sort of finish off with a bit about where it all goes from here. The first thing, of course, is that we have at least up till the sort of July, August time in the UK got an awful lot more people who were really engaged with poverty issues and wanted to do something. The real challenge now is to keep people engaged. Because, of course, this isn't a short-term thing. You know, even though we've had some gains this year, you know, you could hear from my description about, you know, how many meetings you have to go through to get these things delivered, that these things are going to have to be pushed and pushed and pushed. And governments are going to have to be held to account for whether they deliver on those promises. We haven't got very far on trade. We've got a long, long way to go on trade. So the battle's not over yet. And it's really a question now about how we can keep people with us and keep that momentum going. That's one bit of it. The second bit is that I've said, you know, the campaign has been much the strongest in the UK. The real issue now is, can we build up the campaigning around the rest of the world so that there is truly a sense of humanity wanting this change and wanting their own governments to have the political will to make these changes and to demand of rich countries that that should happen. So building that up is quite a challenge. You know, running the Make, or being part of the Make Poverty History Coalition in the UK is difficult enough, but holding a whole global call to action together when people are coming from very different circumstances in different countries, you know, is again a really difficult thing to do, especially as they're all at the beginnings of this whole sort of push for action against poverty. So that's really a second part of it. But I think for us in an organisation like Oxfam, we've also got to do quite a lot of work on the ground. As more money comes through with aid and debt relief, it's quite clear that we have to help strengthen local civil society, particularly in places like Africa, so that it can really monitor where this money goes. Because it's one thing, the money actually coming into these countries, but that's no good if it doesn't reach the people in better health or better education services. Now, a number of NGOs have got experience now in building national coalitions that really do track budgets, that really look at where debt relief monies went to and so on. But with more money coming through, that's going to be increasingly important because that is the only way that you can offset the corruption and the poor governance that's actually going on. Well, not maybe not the only way, but a very important way. We also have to keep lobbying and working with northern companies, for example, to deal with some of these corruption issues. We're part of another alliance called Publish What You Pay, which is making sure that payments by companies, for instance, the big oil companies or extractive industry companies, if they make large payments to southern governments, that money is published so that, again, local civil society can really track where that money is and where it goes. So it's not just more campaigning that's needed. It is actually really strengthening the work on the ground, particularly through local NGOs, so that they really can themselves look at local government, track that money down to the school. And there are wonderful examples where the budget for the school is actually nailed on the school door so that the local parents can actually see, well, did the money ever arrive that was meant to arrive at this school, and actually, you know, do something about it and challenge that. So there is still an awful, awful long way to go. But for me, being part of Oxfam this year, I mean, it's been fantastic to see the way people have responded and the tremendously, you know, positive spirit the whole thing's been done in. I was lucky to be in Edinburgh for the big march, the 225,000 people march. And it was just incredible because it was ordinary people. It was people, you know, there were babies in pushchairs, There were grannies in wheelchairs, and there was everybody in between. And it was all very constructive and positive. And it was people not just demonstrating, it was more like people propositioning and saying what they wanted. And that was a fantastic experience to be part of. So just two slides to finish with. I think one has already sort of been demonstrated, but I'll just put it up. Oh, it's not going to go. Yeah, it is.
To free humanity from poverty, disease.
Millions among the living struggle to survive in conditions of poverty.
There can be change. There can be hope for Africa.
Éradiquer la faim, la pauvreté, la maladie.
First generation that can end extreme poverty. By that I mean the kind of stupid poverty that allows a child to die of hunger in a world of plenty.
2005 is the year to make history, to make poverty history.
But how it happens, it's up to us all.
To make it the most powerful movement the world has ever known, we need all citizens around the world to stand up and be counted.
We're calling for trade justice, an end to debt, and more and better aid.
2005 has to be the decisive year in the battle against poverty.
I'm going to be joining millions of others around the world by wearing my white band in 2005.
Make poverty history.
You know what they say, if you want to make sure your audience has got the message, you just keep repeating yourself. So at that point, I'm going to stop and say, well, I hope that's convinced you, and now we can talk and debate some of the issues that this has all brought up. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for a very stimulating talk and for pointing out some of the challenges of trying to hold a coalition together and the issues of co-option and some of the challenges for the future. I'm now going to open up the discussion for questions. Before I do so, if you're intending to leave within the next 40 minutes, we'll finish at 7:45. Please could you leave now so as not to disrupt the flow of debate? So just wait a moment. Okay, yeah. There probably some people come in because they overflowed, so. Yes, it's on, actually. Okay, so when we take questions, some people will be coming in also now into the spare seats. I'm very pleased to say that this is another event that has been overflowing at the seams, and we also have a video link this evening. Okay, when you ask your question, please can you keep them brief and give your name and as institution affiliation? And yes, please. So I've got one gentleman over there.
Thank you. I was just wondering, you mentioned the World Bank just briefly, and what is your opinion of the World Bank in the fight against poverty? Are they an enemy? Are they an ally? And also with that, what has your impression been of Paul Wolfowitz in his first 6 months as a president of the World Bank? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Question on the World Bank, friend or foe, and what do you think about Paul Wolfowitz?
World Bank, yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bag, but it's better than the IMF, really. it's a mixed bag in the sense that I think they have moved a lot in policy terms in the last sort of 8 years or so. I mean, moving away, you know, from the structural adjustment programs and into better policies, you know, the policy reduction strategies in principle are a good thing, you know, engaging the country in defining its own way out of poverty. The problem is that whatever's set in policy doesn't quite seem to reach the ground. You know, you go in and you have all these arguments and they become convinced, for example, that user fees should be disposed of in education. And in policy terms, it sits there. In practice, in country, you know that the World Bank representatives aren't arguing with the local governments that that's the right thing. They're probably saying quite the opposite. So one of the problems is, although the policies have improved somewhat in recent years, the sort of, you know, head-to-toe touching doesn't work. So you still get an awful lot of very bad things happening in countries that basically we keep trying to expose. Like, I think it was in Tanzania where we were talking about, you know, all these conditions that the World Bank puts on. And I think we totted up amongst all the donors and the World Bank between them. They put 75 policy conditions on Tanzania. It was Tanzania or Zambia, I can't remember which one now, but just ridiculous amounts of, you know, very serious policy change that people were expecting for actually getting aid money. So it's a bit of a problem, really. Now, Wolfowitz is a real conundrum. I don't know what I think about him yet. In some ways, he's done the right things. Because, you know, we pressed him very hard on the multilateral debt relief before the annual meeting, saying, you know, this was really your chance to show that you weren't in the pocket of the American government, but, you know, we're going to really push for this and push for the money to flow through, you know, from the donor governments. And actually, he did do that. But I don't know yet what he's really up to. I don't know, although he's, as I say, he's done one or two things in the first 6 months that have been quite pleasing. You know, more of the, you know, he did persuade the American government, I think, to put more into G8 than we expected. But what's he really about? What's he going to turn the World Bank into? I don't think we've any idea yet. And I don't know, I've heard recently, this may be just a bit of gossip, but that he still hasn't had a proper meeting with all his vice presidents. Well, how can you run an organisation if you haven't really told them what you want to do with it? So I'm still sceptical, still hanging in there, wondering what he's going to be like. Absolutely charming man, very bright, no doubt about that.
Yes, gentlemen.
Thanks very much. There's a criticism of Oxfam and Make Poverty History campaign sometimes that it's full of...
Can you speak up, please?
Yeah, there's a criticism sometimes of Oxfam and Make Poverty History that they're full of slogans but don't have so much substance. I wonder if you could be a bit more specific about one of the things on one of your slides earlier, on the trade slide, which is obviously the big challenge now. I think the slide said, make laws to stop businesses profiting from people or the environment. What do you actually mean by that? What sort of laws? What are the institutions that are going to be governing those? How do you enforce them?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that is a more difficult one. That there are a number of facets to that. I mean, first of all, I think let me speak from Oxfam specifically. What we would say is people need laws, first of all, in their own countries. That whether it's labour laws or environment laws, in the end, it's got to be really the local people who really have good laws that can actually control what's happening in their own country. But equally, you can do some things at the international level, which is why, again, you know, that Publish What You Pay initiative that I've been talking about, we've been arguing that that should not be voluntary, that should be required, that businesses do have to publish what they're giving in payments to governments in the South. If you're a company based in the UK or in the US or wherever, then you should, as part of your accounting, actually have to disclose what you're paying to governments in the South. Now, I mean, you have to do that in the country you're in. At the moment, you don't have to do that in the South. That's some of the sort of things. We're also talking more about, I mean, there's an OECD ruling, sort of convention, on bribery, and the issue is, could you make that more binding on people? Of course, that's a nice convention that, you know, people can sort of go along with or not, but can you make some of those things much more legally binding across countries, across the world internationally, which of course would take UN conventions to do that. So those are the sorts of things that you could put in place, you know, to be more binding on companies and the way they operate.
You mentioned mentioned in your introductory remarks that a sick child cannot attend school and have the benefit of an education. I note that the Cut the Cost campaign is no longer running at Oxfam. Given the recent press reports on the bird flu, a potential pandemic, with the benefit of hindsight, would Oxfam have stopped the Cut the Cost campaign? And perhaps I'd invite you to comment more generally about how Oxfam makes strategic decisions about which campaigns to run and end at particular times.
Well, I don't think we've ever stopped the Cut the Cost campaign. We've just actually taken it from, you know, sort of very big, you know, push, push, push to a lower level, because actually through the last few years we've been working very closely with quite a number of governments really to try to do what they can do through through the trade agreements about what you can do on TRIPS, you know, the intellectual property rights, which is the big essence of the debate in this one. So that's been going on through the time, but you're quite right, we haven't done it at such a high level. You'll be pleased to know that probably next year we're going to really pick it up and run with this whole TRIPS issue again, because it's time for another push on it, actually. Unfortunately, Tamiflu may walk right into our hands to do that, in the sense that, you know, it's a bit like the one, you remember the anthrax problem in the US a bit back? Again, that was so blatantly obvious that when the US, or Tamiflu, it'll be, you know, sort of our countries as well, you know, feels that there is a public health problem, they will do anything to get the stuff. You know, they will, you know, say that you have to have generic products for Tamiflu or whatever it is. All those things, suddenly all those rules that they stop developing countries using suddenly become perfectly acceptable for our countries to do. And that's what's happening with Tamiflu, really, right as we speak. And, you know, and that's where we're certainly going to be saying, you know, if it's all right for us and Tamiflu, why isn't it right, you know, for, well, HIV/AIDS drugs or whatever in the South? So that's coming back. Now you ask a wider question about how we decide on all these things. And this is very complicated, to say the least. One of the issues is, to what extent can you hold the public's attention to an issue? And how is it, you know, sometimes you have to keep moving on from subjects, but trying to illustrate the basic point. So let me give the agriculture example. What we've tried to do with agriculture is to say that there are a whole number of products that just show how unfair the trade rules are on agriculture. And we have to keep taking another one to illustrate the point. So we did a big push on coffee, you know, just how appalling it was for, you know, the prices paid to coffee farmers. You go on to sugar and you show how the sugar regime just puts money into you know, basically very well-to-do farmers' hands mostly. And you have to keep illustrating through different things, because it really is hard to keep the media and the public's attention. So that's a really, you know, that is a really big issue about, you know, how, you know, the stuff is never delivered. You know, we're still, you know, pressing. You get some gains, but, you know, how long is the public really going to be interested in this? I mean, I feel quite good about Cut the Cost. I mean, the costs of drugs, I think it was, the figure is, at the start of the Cut the Cost campaign, it was £12,000, $12,000 a person a year to be treated with HIV/AIDS drugs. In Africa now, the drugs are available at $200 a person a year. So that's, you know, that's really good news. But it clearly hasn't solved the whole problem. It hasn't solved the whole problem of drug prices, and it hasn't solved the whole problem about how you get the drugs delivered either. So, but it's a perpetual balance between keeping up the interest and the momentum and seeing, you know, pressing people to do more things, knowing that actually these are very long-term campaigns. We're not going to stop on trade. That will go on and on for a long time yet, because it's so far away from being delivered. But you have to keep illustrating, I think, with different aspects of that. But anyway, TRIPS will be back with you again next year, and we can all try and understand the legislation on TRIPS again.
Thank you. I had a question up here. Can we get a microphone up there?
There's one coming, I think, for you. Maybe take another one.
Okay, while the microphone is going up, I'll take, there's a question here.
Angela Franklin, you said, as you said just now, you work quite a bit with governments, and you mentioned G7, G8, and UN, and so on, which is all governments. And it seems, looking at it, maybe, unfortunately, governments and even democracy might be part of the problem. We're saying that we need to get the masses involved and keep telling them what's going on and try and help them to remember and all the details of the things, for instance, that you've just mentioned. But sometimes to get people on board, we might need more things like not just how much of the world someone out there spent on arms, but for instance, how much are we in the wealthy West spending every Christmas on toys for children or drinking cups of coffee at Starbucks or anywhere else, not mentioning any particular one. And so that people might get to the situation, and I think compared with your comparison with Victorian Britain was good, in that it wasn't the masses that got there, and I think it's not going to be the masses of the world, but the people in the West who are all very well off, virtually all very well off, then maybe those masses, if they could simply say to their government, you sort it out, without them having to know all the details, you could tell the governments. But democracy means, unless the votes are at risk, the governments, are they going to take any notice? You talked of all the people in Edinburgh. Well, many times that number, of course, marched against the war. Did the government take any notice? No. And when it came to the next election, did those people vote them out because of it? No, because as our democracy goes, we're more interested in how is the NHS doing here and are the taxes fair here. And though we were all against the war, so to speak, yes, there are other things to remember, and votes were not at stake, and they're probably never going to be at stake like that over any of these issues. I just don't know what the answer is, but I feel there might be different ways to approach it. I hope so.
Yeah. Well, I think, I'm not sure I want to comment much on that. I think that's very good, and that actually illustrates a whole load of the dilemmas that there are, really, in how you do all this. And you're right. I mean, governments don't think that poverty is such an issue that votes are really there. And that's why I think we have to mobilise so much to show them that a lot of people do actually care, even so. My immediate reaction on the stop the war in Iraq thing was, it may not have stopped the Iraq war, but it may stop the Iran war yet. You know, sometimes you have to look at these things about how they work over a period of time. You know, we wish it would have stopped the Iraq war, but you know, there we are. We know there was too much already. There was too much political capital at stake already in that one. But I do think we have to sort of think about this business about people. I always love it. This is with any of our political parties. Oxfam has 500,000 regular monthly givers. And that, as I happen to know, is more than any other membership of any political party. So actually, when you say you've got a lot of backing behind you, that is taken rather seriously, actually. I have to say, particularly by the Labour Party, since a lot of those 500,000 may well be Labour sympathisers. I don't mean Labour members, but the people that they'd like to, you know, have voting for them. So every time we criticise the government, you can sort of see a gulp, because actually it is known how many people are out there and supporting. So I don't think we should underestimate our power either, is my answer to that, I think. But yeah, you're right, there are lots of dilemmas and issues.
Okay, thank you. Can you remember to give your name and institution affiliation when you ask a question? And we'll take the question upstairs. Thank you.
Stephanie Dowsin, I'm a master's student at LSE. I don't think I agree with you that much with the idea that if you eradicate debt or cancel debt, you'll actually make poverty history. I think, on the contrary, it gives out the wrong message to developing countries, and it actually probably exacerbates the problem by creating this vicious circle that governments can just borrow and borrow and borrow, and it's all free. And you know, I don't think that actually. I think that creates more problems than it solves. So, what do you think about that?
Well, that was the argument that people used to put. You know, the IMF and everybody used to put sort of 6-8 years ago very strongly. I think the central issue to it, though, is first of all, can anybody ever pay off that debt? And the answer in these countries, these poorest countries, is no. The other thing is, where did this debt come from? And quite often it was some pretty corrupt leaders who actually got themselves into serious debt to do a whole load of projects that their people didn't want. So I agree with you, there is a problem. You know, the moral hazard, you know, problem about, you know, thinking you can get something for nothing. But I think that's where the whole set of good governance, the things that are going on in Africa now about the peer reviews, you know, governments checking each other, has to come into play, really. And there has to be, you know, along with the debt relief, there has to be the real measures about countries cannot get themselves into that debt again. But the reason, personally, I think the debt relief is so strong, it's money that can be used by governments without all the strings that come attached with it for aid. That's one of the big issues. You know, I had a slide that we didn't quite make it to that just shows what debt relief, you know, could do in Uganda with education, the number of children that got into school when their first round debt relief came through. And you just see what a difference that is making. Now, I agree with you. You can't let countries go back into that amount of debt. But I don't think they're going to get out of poverty with the debts they've got, because they're paying so much in interest payments, basically. Anyway, we can. Oh, it's got everybody going now.
My question is, when you mentioned that extreme poverty could be alleviated, you were talking about $1 or $2 a day. Mm. Now, how will you evaluate the success of the Make Poverty History campaign? By saying, okay, more people are living beyond the $1 or $2 a day. But does that mean that poverty has been made history? Because as many people know, that's a problematic indicator. I wanted to see what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah. Well, the whole set of indicators is quite problematic, but I guess where I'd start from is, at least with the package that's in the Millennium Development Goals, that you do have a whole range of indicators that are not just actual income wealth. You know, they are the other things about numbers of children that are in school, maternal mortality, infant mortality, all those sorts of things that are in there. And you need to look at them all, but any one, just the income statistic isn't adequate for what you're doing. But by the time you've added up that group, you're getting a real sense of whether people are getting out of at least that, you know, as I say, that extreme poverty. Now, others will argue that the Millennium Development Goals don't go far enough. And that's a perfectly valid measure, a valid view. But you know, at least if we could hit all those, that would be a pretty good start, it seems to me.
The gentleman at the back.
Hi, I'm Tapiwa. I'm not a student, I'm just a simple African. How would you convince me? I'm one of the biggest opponents of foreign aid. That foreign aid or debt relief works, because in my opinion and in my experience, foreign aid doesn't really, or debt relief doesn't really affect the day-to-day life of the average man on the ground. In fact, I think it kind of exacerbates the position, because foreign aid is used as a political weapon. You vote for me and you'll get aid. You live in a region that didn't vote for me, you don't get aid. And I'm not convinced that Africa is, or the third world, are entirely so poor that they can't work themselves out. I mean, some of those arms that you spoke about, the $1 trillion, is spent by the third world. Your video clip, for example, showed an interesting rubbish dump where people are picking up rubbish to survive. Somehow, I don't think that rubbish was shipped from the UK. I think you will find that there are people, the same people that governments around the world will speak to, the think tanks, the powers that be, and they benefit from the pork barrel. And obviously, they will say, yes, please send us more money. Because even if aid does trickle down, they benefit. There's a lot of graft, and there's a lot of ways of skimming from the top. And what would you say to somebody like me who is totally opposed to foreign aid on those grounds and would argue that maybe the trade issue should be a bigger priority, that you give people a chance to work, and when they work for themselves, it's easier for politicians to steal. When they're less dependent on foreign aid distributed by local corrupt governments, it's easier for them to bring about regime change.
Well, I have no dispute with you about trade. I think trade is incredibly important. And as you say, it has all the right incentives in it, in that it is people working themselves out of poverty if you get rid of some of these nasty rules that stop them doing it. So I don't have any dispute about that. But I do think that for some of the poorest countries, that you're not going to be able to do that without some of the other things that go along with that, in particular education and basic health services. And that a number of countries just simply don't have the money to do that. If you you may disagree with that, but if that's the case, then you have to deal with a set of problems that you're describing, which is that you don't want foreign aid to come with lots of strings attached, and there has been a lot of very bad foreign aid, you know, as I said, where you know, conditions have been put on countries about how they want to change. You do have to put on the condition, though, that the money goes to where it's supposed to go to. You know, the actual follow-through of money is something that has to be done as part of aid. Now, it can be in a country that's sort of, you know, not the most corrupt, but maybe not perfect. You can actually go along with the view that here is a policy poverty reduction strategy. Here, this money is going to be put into this for this sort of set of issues, and that can be tracked. And you have to do that. There are some countries, though, where the monies are just simply not going to be right and possible to put in that way. And then we get into the dilemma about what you do with those countries that really have such corrupt governments. And at the moment, the only answer to that is to try to build up local NGOs, international NGOs, churches, whatever, to actually deliver some of these services anyway and to get some of the money to them while you go about trying to get those governments to behave in a very different way. And that's the complexity of the problem, I think. But I don't think in a lot of those countries you're going to get there without significant aid going in, aid or debt relief at least.
It's a gentleman here.
Mohammed Crescent from Muslim Aid. Just wondered, I think it was John Maynard Keynes who said, who warned us a little about figures and said, statistics and more damn lies. Would you maybe just sort of following on maybe from the comment from the back about aid itself and maybe shed some more light on the different kind of types of aids that we're actually talking about. When we look at a lot of the overseas development assistance, actually perhaps there's a huge mix between them being grants and actually loans to a huge extent as well, and also maybe the phenomenon of tide aid. And I think it was ActionAid recently who had that wonderful research on the phantom aid.
Yeah.
And what is our role now as civil society in terms of ensuring that our governments don't get away with all these statistics?
Well, the issue is about monitoring what they say and what they do and getting as much, you know, information out as you possibly can. No, I mean, the ActionAid report, I think, in many respects, was very good. I mean, the tide aid, you know, where this is where Japan's a great example of it. You give aid, but then you make them spend it on Japanese contractors. You know, that's tide aid. And, you know, that's absolutely outrageous, usually, because it doesn't actually do anything then to help the country really develop. I think there are some boundaries on that, though. There was one bit in the ActionAid report that I guess we had a bit more question about, and that's some of the technical assistance. Because in some of the poorest countries, unless they build up their local institutions, you know, local authorities, central government authorities, they're never going to be able to deliver the things that we want them to deliver. So I think you've got to be a bit careful about what you put in that. But yeah, all that money ought to be, you know, we all have a very important role in actually monitoring what that money is, you know, what sort of aid it's going into. But it has to be, you know, it's that thing I was saying about budget monitoring and tracking. We've got to build up local NGOs in country too, so that they can really see what this money is coming in for and where it's going. So it's both ends. It's, you know, the northern end that's giving the money, but, you know, it's got to be in the south too, standing up for that.
I've been left rather puzzled, even so, about the success of the campaign in respect of the £50 billion that the G8 have increased the amount of aid to. They are going to increase it by 2010.
Yep.
But I've heard two different points of view about that. I understand that some of the agencies, possibly yours included, have been disappointed that it isn't being increased immediately. On the other hand, I understand that some of the members of, maybe all of them, the African members of the Commission for Africa have said that if it were increased immediately, the African countries wouldn't be able to absorb it or deal with it effectively enough.
Yeah.
I represented my parish in the marked in Edinburgh, and I'd like to be able to give them some useful information about that so that they understand the campaign as well as possible.
Yeah. Well, this is quite a big debate, and you know, the technical term for the debate is absorptive capacity. Can Africa or wherever absorb that amount of aid? Now, that is in dispute. I mean, the World Bank, for all its sins, has done an analysis and says, actually, quite a lot of that money could be poured into Africa, Africa's share of this could be poured in right now, and there would be ways to deliver this, because there's so much that needs to be done, basically. One of my staff members talks about, for instance, salaries of nurses, doctors, health workers are not, you know, sort of necessarily fully qualified like our doctors, but teachers and so on. We have so many people in so many developing countries who are paid virtually nothing, yet they're meant to deliver public services, which in itself causes a level of corruption in that you then have to get parents to pay, even though it's meant to be free. That actually, just by putting in quite a lot more into staff salaries, you could probably A, use up quite a lot of money, and B, do something quite good for a lot of these services. So I think it's clear more money could go in. I don't think any of us honestly know how fast that would really work, really. It just feels like wait until 2010 seems an awful long time, and getting some more momentum up sooner would, because of those reasons, would be good. But also to get the money flowing, because like the conversations we've been having, we want to make sure this money is coming and that it's not offset and delayed and all the things that happen in these massive, sort of international processes, really. So I think that's the other part of it, get this stuff moving, really.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to take three questions and cluster them. The lady at the back over there, lady in the front here, sorry, lady, person in the front here, and gentleman here.
Hi, I'm Koinor Chowdhury. I used to study here years ago. Just in response to the lady before who mentioned free borrowing, I just wanted to say, sometimes an example that's given is if I was to borrow money from HSBC, we wouldn't expect my great-great-grandchildren to be still repaying that loan. So that's that lady. To the gentleman here who mentioned debt relief, and he sort of put it together, lumped it together with aid, I just wanted to say they're two very separate things. With debt relief, if someone... when you have debt relief, a country can then have greater resources to pay towards public services, so you shouldn't put those two together. Right. Now, my question is, you were talking about multilateral debt relief. I understand that the private companies own far greater debt. What steps are being taken towards that?
Okay, I'll take the two more questions, and please keep them brief so we have maximum questioning. Yeah, here.
Thank you. You mentioned that one of the challenges now is to strengthen more the work of local NGOs. I'd like to know if Oxfam has a specific strategy on how to go about doing this and strengthening international coalitions also. And if you could just give us an idea of the amount and proportion of resources, staff that goes into these kinds of activities versus the broader campaigning activities.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed Barnett. It may be actually slightly linked to that idea. A question of legitimacy in terms of campaigning on others' behalf. And it seems that the campaign to make poverty history is campaigning on behalf of those concerned. And if we looked at the advertisement, they were all leaders of national governments or from France, the UK, or leaders of multilateral organizations. What is Oxfam doing maybe to try and give voice to those who are concerned, and why weren't we hearing the voices of those concerned in those kind of adverts?
I don't feel I'm a real expert on private sector debt. I mean, I know there are discussions going on about that and whether that is actually feasible to really deal with private sector debt. But honestly, I'd have to get back to you on that, because I just don't feel I'm an expert. I'm having enough trouble with multilateral debt myself. But you know, but there are people in my place who could do a bit more. Or maybe there's somebody in the room who knows what's actually happening at the moment. But I mean, discussions are there, but whether it's, I don't know where they've got to. The strategy for local NGOs, yeah. Usually what happens in the countries where this has been going on, and it's not just Oxfam, other NGOs have been doing this, usually sometimes it starts by funding a small local NGO that had started maybe doing, started thinking about doing some budget monitoring or something to try to, you know, to try to help strengthen them, to put some money and resources into them. Sometimes it could be right at the grassroots level, you know, parent-teachers associations, for example, already supporting them, but saying, you know, why don't you have a look at the budgets that are coming through? And then helping them think through how to do that. So it can be incredibly local level stuff, or it can be more at the national level where there are already some groups beginning to work in those ways. So it's often putting some financial support in, but often putting some technical support about how you go about this. How do you go about monitoring budgets at the, you know, the most basic level? And then in a number of countries, it's really working with coalitions that can come together, because you might have an education coalition, for example, that its main thing was to get all girls into school or something, but that they got interested in budget monitoring. And then you'll find that in a different sector, there's another NGO that's actually looking at another part of where the budget flows. And quite often it's bringing some of those together in national coalitions to say, you know, well, let's all look at these money flows. And the example of that is Uganda's a very strong one. The debt network in Uganda is different groupings who can track and watch different things but come together as a national coalition. So I think it'll be depending on which country, you know, and what's already in place, what support can be given, those sorts of issues, really. You ask about staff on that versus campaigning. It's very hard to know. I mean, there won't be, because our programmes, certainly in Oxfam, are not huge on things like budget tracking. It's not going to be huge amounts of money or huge numbers of staff. But of course, this is only support to those groups. It's the partner agencies that are really doing, you know, the work on this. We're only adding our support into that, really. And of course, that will be, you know, as I said, in somewhere like Uganda, can be really quite strong and with a lot of people involved. But it's not going to be a lot of Oxfam staff. Trying to answer your question about numbers of staff, it's really quite difficult, actually, because if you take Oxfam overall in the world right now, we've got 6,200 staff, but a lot of them are doing things like tsunami relief in Pakistan and all sorts of things. But the number of campaign staff that we have in Oxford doing a lot of the advocacy and campaigning is about 150 in total, including all the research that's done and everything. So it sounds like a very small proportion, but, you know, those are people with some big clout, actually, if they, you know, you really get the research done. So it's a bit of a different mix. Now, legitimacy is another bit of this. Yeah, what we really feel very strongly about is that we must not speak on behalf of. We can describe the circumstances of people in poverty from the work that we see on the ground. But as much as possible, people must speak for themselves. So, for example, we took cotton farmers to Cancun for the last World Trade Organization meeting so that they could speak for themselves about what their problems were with cotton subsidies in the US. All the big international meetings that we do that. The Global Call to Action, we brought over the leaders of the 40 of the national networks to come to Edinburgh to be part of the Global Action so that it was all of us together and not just Northern voices. I think the reason that particular ad came out in that way was it was very much about trying to get people persuaded to really have a go at Tony Blair and at the other G8 governments. That was where it was at. But of course, the person who started the campaign was Nelson Mandela. We brought him to Trafalgar Square, and he launched Make Poverty History. He was the one who said, you know, it can be done. You know, basically, it's a crime against humanity not to do it. Because he has such credibility north and south. But I don't think it's so much the figureheads. It is really the people have to speak for themselves, and we have to take people into these meetings, into these places where they can have power. And they are very powerful because they speak from reality. You know, a cotton farmer from West Africa who's being done out of any farming income by American subsidized farmers, he feels very strongly about it, and he speaks more powerful than any Oxfam staff member could, or any lobbyist. So.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed for a very interesting, stimulating talk. And again, I think we're delighted to be the first to hear your reflections on Making Poverty History campaign. And I'd like to give you a big round of applause. Thank you. And if you're in Hong Kong in December, don't forget to wear your white armband.